Welcome to Nocturnal Tales. Tonight we find ourselves on a frost-edge platform in the English countryside, where Captain Hastings encounters a familiar face, a gentleman who should not, by all accounts, be there at all. Hercule Poirot is soon drawn into a mystery involving a vanished man, a fortune in banknotes, and a trail that winds through chalk pits, boardrooms, and the shadows of the past. This is The Gentleman on the Platform, an original tale crafted in the spirit of Agatha Christie, where reason meets the inexplicable, and sometimes the truth leaves room for mystery. Before we commence, pray enlighten us in the comments. What precise activity occupies your little grey cells as you listen to this unfolding puzzle? Are you at your desk, walking, or curled up by lamplight? Your presence here is what keeps these stories alive. Producing these tales, writing, narrating, illustrating, takes many hours, and direct listener support allows us to keep creating them to the standard you enjoy. If you'd like to help us continue, you can join our membership for ad-free listening and exclusive content, or leave a small tip. Every contribution, large or small, helps ensure that Nocturnal Tales endures. Now, let the story unfold. Chapter 1. The Journey to Brackwell. It is a strange thing how the smallest domestic inconvenience can decide the course of events. Had there been two adjoining first-class seats available on the 4:15 to Chatterford that December afternoon, I might never have found myself, a few hours later, telling an incredulous dinner table that I had spent part of my journey conversing with a gentleman who, on everyone's showing but my own, could not have been there to converse with me at all. The day had begun in that particular London gloom which I have always associated with the latter end of the year, a softened light, as if the city were under a bell glass of fog, and everything, pavements, hansoms, the very faces of the passers-by, somehow muffled and remote. I confess I have a fondness for such days. They make one think of warm lamps and drawing-rooms, and most of all of Christmas. I had been invited to spend a week at Haversley Hall with Colonel and Mrs. Harcourt, old friends to whom I owe many kindnesses, and I looked forward to it with hearty anticipation. Good talk, good food, and the sort of country comforts in which, for all my soldier's training, I am unashamed to delight. I had visions, too, of a modest shoot if the weather would oblige, and of Mrs. Harcourt's Christmas pudding, which has, in certain circles, acquired an almost legendary reputation. Poirot, who was to accompany me, looked upon the expedition with a different eye. My distinguished friend regards the English country house as a theatre admirably designed for human drama, but he does not relish its draughts. He is, I need hardly say, the neatest and warmest of men, and views a stray ember upon a hearthrug, much as he would a loaded revolver carelessly left upon a nursery table. "For a week, Hastings," he said, drawing on his gloves with meticulous care as we stepped from the taxi at Victoria, "I consent to exchange my perfectly regulated apartment for the surprises of the provinces. There will be fires that smoke, beds that sigh, and windows that, how do you say, whistle. But à la bonne heure, we shall have the society, and Madame Harcourt has the true tact with her seating plans. You will be flattered and cosseted within an inch of your life," I laughed. "Only take care you do not promise to unmask the family skeleton by Twelfth Night." He lifted a finger. "I promise nothing, I observe." The station had the aspect common to great termini at that hour. Porters trundling improbable pyramids of luggage, a swift succession of partings, all remarkably similar in their protestations, travellers with their faces turned already to the country, and that melancholy figure, the man who arrives just in time to realise he has missed his train. The 4:15 stood ready, gleaming and important. We went at once to the booking office, where I asked for two first-class to Chatterford, and added, out of habit rather than necessity, "Together, if you please." The clerk, who had the pinched look of a man born to disappoint, consulted a diagram and shook his head. "Regret impossible, sir. No adjacent first-class seats available as far as Chatterford. I can put you both in first, but different compartments." Poirot made the face he reserves for inferior soufflés. "Separate compartments, mon Dieu. But perhaps it is the best. In a crowd, one is jostled. One's knees are endangered. The little grey cells are bruised. Give me one seat, if it is quiet, and give to my ami Hastings another. He is a good traveller. He is the oak." "The oak?" I protested. "The oak is robust." "Also, it does not change its place," returned Poirot placidly. "It is, how do you say, philosophical." The clerk, with the weary air of one who has long ceased to interest himself in the habits of trees or Belgians, clipped the tickets and slid them across to me. A porter secured our luggage. We walked the length of the platform to the first-class coaches. Poirot, after a swift reconnaissance marked by little pursings of the lips — he likes a carriage that has been swept twice — chose a forward compartment in which two ladies already sat, enveloped in rugs and self-satisfaction. I was shepherded by the guard, a ruddy, competent fellow, toward the rear of the train, and shown a compartment that was, to my surprise, entirely empty. It occurred to me at once that the booking clerk must have been mistaken about there being no two seats together in first class. Here was a whole compartment unclaimed, and plenty of space for us both. But Poirot, having secured his quiet corner, would not be moved, and I was not sorry to have a little room to myself. "Will you be wishful to travel private, sir?" the guard asked. "I can lock you in." "I don't insist," I said, "but I confess I shouldn't object. My friend, Mr. Hercule Poirot, is in the forward carriages. If there's any difficulty..." "None at all, sir. Ticket, if you please." He punched it, slid the door, and with an air almost paternal, turned the key. I settled myself with a sensation of snug possession. The glass was already beaded with the fine damp of the afternoon. A lamp threw a respectable pool of light. The leather was well kept. And the little net shelves above were empty, save for a folded newspaper someone had left behind that morning. I placed my hat opposite me, my overcoat beside it, and drew from my pocket the latest number of an evening paper to glance at the football results. It was a pleasant arrangement, and for a moment I imagined the journey passing in comfortable solitude. But my solitude, as it turned out, was not to last. Chapter 2. The Vanishing. We were within a minute of starting when a figure came quickly along the platform, tall, spare, with that faint stoop of the shoulders which suggests a man accustomed to carrying his thoughts at a higher pitch than his head. Without ceremony he produced, to my surprise, a key, opened the door, and stepped into my sanctuary as if it had been reserved for him by Act of Parliament. He carried a japanned deed box, which he put beneath the seat with the precautionary care of one who has so placed it many times before, and a light waterproof which he spread across his knees. Then, removing his hat, he disclosed the lofty furrowed brow and close-cut grey hair of a face that stirred my memory. It is always annoying to know one knows, and not be able for a second to say whom. But as he exchanged his hat for a travelling cap, the line of the mouth declared itself, and I said, "Mr. Davenham, surely." He turned his light eyes upon me with a courteous absence of surprise. "Yes," he said, "and you are?" "Arthur Hastings. We met at Haversley Hall some years ago, at the Harcourts." "The Harcourts, ah yes, you are the soldier." "I was," I smiled. "Now I am reduced to peace and to making myself useful to my friend Monsieur Hercule Poirot, who is, by the way, on this train." "Indeed." He showed no eagerness at the news. "He has the name, certainly." "He has more than the name," I said warmly. "But perhaps you are not bound for Chatterford."
"Not by this train," he returned. "I leave presently at Brackwell. Business. Tiresome business." He spoke not as if business were disagreeable to him by nature, but as if this particular parcel of it had been rubbed in salt before it was handed to him. It was then, as the train glided forward with that smooth assurance that always gives me a small boy's thrill, that he entered, with no further ceremony of preface, upon a description of his affairs. He proved a talker of the class that relieves itself by narration rather than seeks to persuade. I have observed a certain type of solicitor who talks as he writes, a series of numbered paragraphs marching to an inevitable conclusion. Mr. Davenham had this style. He spoke of the Southern Metropolitan Railway and of a new branch line projected between Brackwell and Marlingworth. It was, he told me, not too modestly, his idea, his labour, his pride. Landowners had to be soothed, councillors squared. He did not use the word, but hinted amiably at the necessities of civilization. Objections met with clauses, and clauses with riders. He described with humour the rector whose glebe would, if the plan were adopted, be cut in two like a child's orange, and who had replied by threatening the directors with excommunication. He had a story, too, of a certain squire who had sworn that no iron track should sever the view from his east windows, and who, upon being offered a sum which would have bought him a new vista and a villa besides, fell upon Davenham's neck and wept, explaining that he was ruined by the expense of keeping up his stables and could not possibly part with a yard of parkland. I must do him the justice to say he made these anecdotes amusing, and I laughed in the right places. But I am not, I confess, a lover of the minutiae of boards and committees. I made one or two civil remarks, and then looked out at the watery dusk, thinking of the welcome at Haversley, and of Mrs. Harcourt's hot punch, which is, in its way, a restorative more subtle than champagne. It was at the point at which my attention wandered that he dropped, with the carelessness of one who has forgotten that not all men go about with well-balanced checkbooks, a remark that brought me up with a jerk. £75,000, he said, tapping his breast pocket lightly. Cash down. Now, £75,000 is impressive, even on paper. In one's breast pocket it assumes a significance almost comical. You can't mean, I began. He inclined his head. But certainly. The deed of sale is for 8:30 this evening. Our friends on the other side will take nothing but notes. There is some nonsense about distrust of banks. You would be surprised, Captain Hastings, at the medieval conservatism of certain English families. I should be more surprised, I returned, to be bandying £75,000 on a winter evening between one solicitor's office and another. It seems an admirable way to secure the cheapest possible funeral. He smiled, a faint drawing back of the lips that showed no amusement in the eyes. You are very natural, but I have carried such sums before. One chooses one's route and one's company, and in any case, he touched the deed box with a little pat, one distributes one's risk. There is not all here, nor all here. With another light tap on his person, a certain proportion is placed beyond the reach of any single mishap. It is a game of percentages. You relieve my mind, though not entirely, I said. May I ask, do you go on from Brackwell to Marlingworth? At once, he returned. By road. There is a conveyance from the Brackwell Arms. We pass, how is it called, the Old Chalk Pits, a short walk from Brackwell Station on the far side of the ridge. The road to Marlingworth skirts them, so we cannot help but go by that way. He said it with the same punctual dryness with which he catalogued his clauses. Yet the words set a little shiver through me, as if the damp outside had found a crevice in the carriage window. Chalk pits, winter, and large sums of money make a combination only poets and policemen relish. We spoke a little of Haversley and the Harcourts. He sent, with that old-fashioned politeness which is almost a mannerism with certain professional men, a message to Mrs. Harcourt. Tell my cousin, he said, that if I come it shall be before Christmas, and that she need not take the trouble to burn down the hall in my honour this time, but she will oblige me by causing the chimney of the Blue Room to be swept. The rooks, if they still inhabit the roof, have a partiality for that flue. The particularity of this request amused me. I promised to deliver it word for word. "And you travel with Monsieur Poirot," he added, more as a statement than a question. "Yes." "Then your arrival will be celebrated by mysteries, no doubt." For the first time there was a gleam in his eye, not purely professional. "I have always thought that man a little too, what shall I say, fond of human nature. It is a perilous affection in a world equipped with blunt instruments." "You will find him better than his reputation," I said warmly. "I hope so," he returned, and fell silent. The carriage lamps made little yellow islands in which our faces swam. Outside, the grey deepened to indigo. Now and again the dark bulk of a copse shouldered itself against the sky, or a string of lights, touring in stately fashion like a chain of glowworms, announced a town before it slid away. We had not long to wait for Brackwell. The train, with that particular reluctance I have noticed when one is most anxious to be done, slackened by degrees and came at last to a formal stand. "Brackwell! Brackwell!" cried the porter, running along the platform, as if the station might otherwise forget its name. Davenham rose, and in rising showed, as all careful men do, that his was a habit of order. He placed his cap in his pocket, replaced his hat, took down his umbrella, took up the waterproof, stooped for the deed box, and set it just so beneath his arm. It was then, as he turned, that something slipped, a small dark object from the inner pocket of his coat. It fell, as such things will, exactly where the least fussy man would tread on it. I was about to warn him when a sudden movement on the platform caught my eye. A man in a close-fitting tweed suit, sandy moustache, slight in build, was standing under a gas jet a few yards along. He had the air of one waiting without seeming to wait. Davenham stepped down. He did not see the dropped article. I did not, in that instant, think to stoop for it. He walked with his composed haste along the carriage, the deed box held as if it were no more than a musical instrument he carried to practice with a friend. He reached the man in tweed. They spoke, earnestly, yet without gesticulation. They moved a yard or two aside from the flow of passengers. They stood for the space of a breath exactly in the pool of light. I saw them clearly. Then, I have no better phrase, the platform was empty. There are, I suppose, explanations for everything. At least I have heard Poirot say so often enough. There are trap doors. There are doors you do not see because you do not expect to see them. There are shelters and angles, and the simple trick of two men turning at once in opposite directions, so that while you follow neither, each is presently out of sight. But I am not inattentive by nature, and I could have sworn that between the lamppost and the blank of advertisements beyond was nothing, simply nothing at all. "Tickets, please." The guard's voice brought me to myself. He appeared at the door with the condescending briskness of functionaries everywhere. "You are for Chatterford, sir," he said. "All right."
"You took my ticket at the last stop," I said mechanically, and then, "the gentleman who travelled with me."
He looked blank. "You had the compartment to yourself, sir." I stared at him. "My dear fellow, you saw me get out a moment ago to catch my friend." "Not you, sir," returned the guard with a good-humoured obstinacy. "You've been in your seat since we left Victoria. But we must be off, if you're staying on, sir." He had his hand already to the door. I hesitated. At my feet lay the small dark object Davenham had dropped. I stooped. It was a Morocco cigar case, the leather worn by use, and on it a silver monogram, two letters elegantly entwined, R.D. I thrust it into my pocket and sprang down onto the platform, determined to have the thing out. At that instant, as if the train had been waiting for an opportunity to betray me, the whistle went. There was a surge and a clank. The carriage moved, and I, having very little desire to be left expansive and solitary upon Brackwell's windy platform, leapt back into my seat. The door slammed, the key turned, and the guard, with an air of benevolent triumph, waved his lantern at me as if to say, "There now." I sat down, breathing rather hard. It is disconcerting to be contradicted by a man who professionally cannot be wrong, and by circumstances which sentimentally cannot be right. I took out the cigar case and examined it. It was of good leather, not new, the edges carefully stitched by hand. Within were two cigars of a brand known to me as the choice of men who do not regard money as a barrier between themselves and comfort. I slipped it back and, for the remainder of the journey, made an effort, ineffectual enough to convince myself that I had been tricked by some common sleight of the eye. Chapter 3. Revelations at Haversley. The dogcart from Haversley met us at Chatterford. I found Poirot already stepping down from his compartment, his small valise in hand, and his hat set at the precise angle he favours for country arrivals. "The journey was most agreeable, mon ami," he said, as if our separation had been the fruit of some carefully designed plan rather than the booking clerk's arrangements. "My companions were two ladies of a most amiable discretion. They spoke not at all, and you?" "I had the place to myself until I didn't," I replied. "Tiens!" His eyes sharpened. "We shall speak of this." The night had come down softly, as if reluctant to commit itself to full darkness. The mare, a spirited black with opinions, made short work of the 9 miles, while the groom, a taciturn young giant with ears more sensitive than his speech, volunteered such information as the weather, the mud between the elms, and the superiority of Colonel Harcourt's new lamps to those recently installed at the vicarage. It was comfortable. It was English. It was everything that the unaccountable episode at Brackwell was not. Haversley Hall, when we swept up between the stone pillars and the lodge lights fell behind, had the look of an establishment that understands its business. Lamps burned in the long windows, smoke went up peaceably from several chimneys, and the front door, opening as we drove in, released a muffled glow, and the figure of Wilkes, the butler, a man constructed on conservative lines and lubricated by discretion. "Good evening, Captain Hastings. Monsieur Poirot," he said, with that faint suggestion of a smile which butlers allow themselves as proof that they think no worse of you than of other human beings. "Mrs. Harcourt begs you will come in at once. Your rooms are ready. Dinner at 8. We followed him inside, shedding the damp air of the journey for the welcome glow of the hall. Mrs. Harcourt entered with the light, quick step of a woman who will not admit that she has gone to meet her guests in the hall, though all the house knows it.
"My dear Captain Hastings," she cried, giving me both hands.
"We are delighted. Monsieur Poirot, you flatter us by coming." Poirot bowed, murmuring one of those little speeches which, in anyone else's mouth, would seem absurd, and in his, charming. We spoke of the journey, of the unseasonable mildness, of a brace of pheasants that had disgraced themselves by flying where they should not. I was about to say, "By the way, I came down with your cousin," when Mrs. Harcourt, with that efficient grace which belongs to hostesses and sergeant-majors, whisked us upstairs to our rooms, stipulating a quarter of an hour for dressing. My room, a bachelor's chamber with chintz in a cheerful pattern of leaves and birds, had a fire that meant business. I unpacked, mislaid a pair of studs while thinking of Brackwell, rediscovered them in the cuff of a shirt, and presently came down to the drawing-room where a party already assembled made that agreeable hum which is the true overture to dinner. We went in 8 or 10 strong, a county baronet with the expression of a handsome sheep, 2 parsons with their wives, a pair of Biddulphs who always, wherever they are, give the impression of having been turned out together by a nursery governess, and a retired officer of the skirmishers, Captain Prendergast, a man with a pleasant laugh and a talent for doing the right thing if you told him what it was beforehand. The table shone. The silver was of the age to which silver aspires. The turkey, arriving in due splendour, was carved by Colonel Harcourt with that competence which makes one love the British Army for its small perfections as much as for its larger triumphs. We talked, as one does, by 2s and 3s across an agreeable barricade of flowers and dishes. I found myself between a rector's wife who, having five children, spoke of them kindly as if they were not her own, and a spinster aunt of Mrs. Harcourt's who held strong views upon the subject of modern novels. It was not until there came that curious pause, which is the natural place for some idiot to say something that all men wish unsaid, that I, moved by a mischievous impulse and that craving to tell one small news which overtakes us at the wrong moment, said lightly, "By the way, Mrs. Harcourt, I came down this afternoon with your cousin, Reginald." It was as if someone had rapped upon the table with a knuckle. Colonel Harcourt laid down his knife and fork. There was a perceptible tightening along the line of faces. Mrs. Harcourt, opposite me, looked up steadily as if she had understood me perfectly and wished very much that she had not. "My cousin," she said after the smallest of pauses. "Reginald?" "Yes. He joined me at the last moment at the station and travelled as far as Brackwell. He asked me to give you his regards and to say," I tried for the exact words, "that you were not to take the trouble to burn down the hall in his honour this time, but that he would be obliged if you would have the chimney of the Blue Room swept. There are moments when the most innocent man becomes aware that he has put his foot with military precision upon a landmine. I became aware of it then, a shade, not quite of colour, rather of expression, passed over Mrs. Harcourt's face. Her lips parted, closed, parted again, and then with courage she said quietly, 'Thank you, Captain Hastings, I will remember.' No one spoke. Captain Prendergast, to his honour, sprang up a conversational rocket in the wrong direction. 'You have been abroad, Captain. Russia, I think. They say there is skating on the canals nearer Christmas, quite the thing again.' I answered him, I hope sensibly. Two or three of the company rallied. The conversation spread like a thin film over deep water, but the current had been felt, and we all knew it. When the ladies withdrew, I found a chair near Poirot and said in a low voice, 'What in heaven's name have I done?' He did not ask me to explain. He never does when he has already understood that there is something to be explained. 'You have spoken the name that is not spoken in this house,' he murmured. 'Attend, Hastings. Say to me now exactly what occurred.' I told him. The separate compartments. The guard who locked my door. The man with the private key. The conversation. The money. The message about the Blue Room chimney. Brackwell. The man in tweed. The vanishing. The guard's assertion that I had been alone. The cigar case lying where it must have fallen from Davenham's pocket. 'And you have the case?' I produced it. He took it, turned it over, touched the monogram with a precise forefinger, opened it, and with a little movement of the lips, which in him is equivalent to a whistle, inhaled the faint, expensive fragrance of the cigars. 'It is very clear,' he said softly. 'It is the thing that is, how do you call it, impossible.' Colonel Harcourt came to us then, his good-humoured face drawn in about the mouth. 'Hastings,' he said, with the abruptness of a man who would like to make an order of the day of his private life, 'tell me, like a good fellow, when and where you think you saw my wife's cousin.' I repeated the bare facts. He heard me out, then looked at the cigar case as one might look at a relic one is not prepared to venerate. 'You are sure of the man?' 'As sure,' I said, 'as I am of you, Harcourt.' He nodded once. 'Then either you have dreamed a remarkably circumstantial dream, or—' He broke off, swallowed, and ended with a soldier's brevity. 'Or there is something here I do not understand, and I do not, by heaven.' 'Sit down,' said Poirot gently. 'You shall tell to us your side, and you shall begin with the month.' Harcourt sat. He looked for a moment as if he had forgotten we were guests. 'In September,' he said, 'Reginald Davenham disappeared. He was a director of the Southern Metropolitan. 3 days later, the company discovered that £75,000, intended, as you have heard, for the purchase of land, had disappeared also. I need not say what the world concluded. There has been a standing order out for his arrest since the 25th. The room seemed very quiet. From somewhere on the far side of the house, the faintest thread of music came and went. Someone, trying over a Christmas carol too early, lost the tune and found it again. I remembered, absurdly, a child at school whom the rest of us could not keep in time. "And yet," said Poirot, looking down at the black Morocco case in his hand, "our Hastings meets him today and receives from him the cigar case that is here. And he learns from him things that, unless he is a medium, he cannot know. Eh bien." Harcourt's large hand closed on the back of the chair till the knuckles whitened. "If you tell me he came down to Brackwell today, I will tell you that every station master, guard, and porter on the line knows his face as well as his own glass, and that he would have been stopped before he had set foot on the platform. I will tell you further that if he had set foot there and not been stopped, there would be resignations tendered tonight without waiting for tomorrow's post." "The guard," I said, "assured me I had travelled alone." "To be sure he did," returned Harcourt grimly. "They are sure of the things that are comfortable to be sure of." Poirot rose. "My friend," he said, laying a hand for a moment on Harcourt's sleeve, "we will not discuss tonight what is to be done tomorrow. Tonight we will give to Madame your wife the tranquillity. But listen well. There is no offense in what our Hastings has said. It is, what shall I say, the fact that does not fit. Always, when you have the fact that does not fit, you must preserve it with the care. It is the key that opens the door you do not yet see." Harcourt's jaw tightened. "If what you say is true, then the Southern Metropolitan Board will need to know at once. Davenham was still officially a wanted man. They'll have heard whispers by morning that he's been spotted on their own railway line." Poirot, who had slipped the cigar case into his pocket as neatly as if it had gone there of its own accord, looked into the fire and said very deliberately, "No, Montcornel, before we go to London, we must make one small excursion here in the country. First, the chalk pits, and afterwards, the board." Harcourt frowned. "The pits? That will put us a day behind." Poirot's tone was courteous, but there was steel in it. "The board will still be sitting the day after tomorrow, will it not? But the chalk pits, ah, they will not wait. A frost like this changes the ground. Marks are lost. If we go in 2 or 3 days, we may see nothing. If we go tomorrow, perhaps we shall see everything." Harcourt's brow darkened. "The chalk pits? Whatever for?" Poirot turned from the fire, his green eyes bright with that particular intensity I had learned to recognize. "Because, Montcornel, your cousin mentioned them quite specifically to our Hastings. The old chalk pits," he said. "A short walk from Brackwell Station on the far side of the ridge. Not some chalk pits or chalk pits in the area, but the old chalk pits, as one speaks of a landmark well known to him." "I don't follow," Harcourt said stiffly. "Ah, but consider. A man carrying £75,000 does not mention casual geography in conversation. Every detail from his lips has purpose. He spoke of his route, to Brackwell, then by road to Marlingworth, passing these pits. Why mention them at all, unless—" Poirot's fingers made a small, precise gesture. "Unless they held significance beyond their position on a map." I felt a chill that had nothing to do with the dying fire. "You think something happened there?" "I think, mon ami, that we have a mystery of a man who appears where he cannot be, who vanishes where he should not, and who speaks of places with the precision of one who knows them intimately." Poirot's voice grew softer, more thoughtful. "Physical evidence, it does not lie as men lie. But it fades, with rain, with frost, with time. If there are answers at these chalk pits, we must find them while they may still be found." The colonel considered this, jaw tightening, then gave a short nod. "Very well, but after that, London, without delay." Poirot inclined his head gravely. "You have my word, mon colonel." The agreement seemed to settle the matter, yet in the pause that followed, I felt the undercurrent still running between them. the Colonel's impatience against Poirot's unhurried certainty. It was like watching two clocks tick in the same room, each keeping perfect time, but to a different measure. And for my part, I could not decide which would prove the truer in the end. It was, I need hardly say, precisely the sort of understanding to leave me as restless as a man who has been given a blanket an inch too short. We rejoined the company. The ladies had coffee. Someone suggested a game, and someone else, thank heaven, extinguished it. The talk resumed its agreeable murmur, a trifle more careful than before. When I came to wish Mrs. Harcourt good night, she held my hand a shade longer than was necessary and said with a brave smile, "You will forgive me, Captain Hastings. It has been difficult with Reginald." I murmured some reassurance. She searched my face for a moment, then said quietly, "You have a good memory." Before we parted for the night, Poirot pressed the cigar case back into my hand. "Keep this safe, mon ami. Tomorrow we shall have need of it again." I went up to my room with that pricking at the back of the neck which is half superstition and half the body's protest at the unknown. I am not by nature easily shaken, and yet, as I set my candle down and the fire rearranged itself with small conspiratorial sighs, I could not help hearing again the porter's cry, "Brackwell! Brackwell!" and seeing, under the lamp, the two men for that instant clear in the yellow circle, before the place where they had been became, with a suddenness almost indecent, only empty air. On my dressing table lay the cigar case. I opened it, closed it, and then, with a sort of irritation at my own nerves, slid it under the corner of a book, as if it were a schoolboy's forbidden treasure. Then I laughed at myself, extinguished the lamp, and got into bed. I have heard it said by men who pretend to know that the mind makes its own ghosts and hangs them upon the convenient pegs of circumstances. Perhaps. But the mind does not, in my experience, manufacture cigar cases monogrammed in silver, nor messages about the chimneys of particular rooms. And as for convenient pegs, well, I have seldom found circumstances particularly accommodating. Be that as it may, I slept at last, and if I dreamed, I do not remember it. I only know that when I woke, with the winter sun insisting upon the edge of the blind, and the bell somewhere below stairs sounding the call to breakfast, my first thought was not of the famous Haversley Kippers, nor of the day's business, but of an empty space beneath a gas lamp on a provincial platform, and of a gentleman in a travelling cap who had told me quite composedly that he had £75,000 about his person and must be at a solicitor's office by 8:30. It is not, you will admit, the sort of recollection that induces a man to dawdle over his shaving. Chapter 4. A Shadow from the Past. If Colonel Harcourt's announcement the night before had left me restless, Poirot's reaction had the opposite effect. His deliberate calm in the face of a puzzle has a way of sharpening one's own curiosity, as though by keeping his conclusions to himself, he leaves everyone else hanging in a state of expectation. It is rather like watching a cat watch a mouse hole. You begin to believe that the creature not only knows the mouse is there, but the precise moment it will emerge. Over breakfast, an excellent kipper, golden and firm, which I shall remember longer than many a case, Poirot was at his neatest and most deliberate. The rest of the household avoided the subject of Davenham, but Poirot and I exchanged enough glances to agree that, once coffee was finished, we would waste no time in returning to Brackwell. "You perceive, Hastings," he said, setting down his cup with precision, "that we have here an affair most curious. There is the man, your man, who is not there. There is also the thing that is there, the cigar case, which makes a contradiction. I adore a contradiction. And there is the reaction of Madame Harcourt and of the Colonel. That, too, we must place in the little grey cells." "Reaction?" I asked. "But certainly. She is startled. Yes, mais pas trop. She already has the picture in her head of what has happened, and it does not surprise her greatly. That, my friend, is interesting." We departed at 9:15, the frost having at last condescended to show itself in a fine silver rime upon the lawns. The same groom drove us back to the station, his conversational range once again confined to the state of the roads. The hall's chimneys trailed ribbons of smoke behind us, and I had the sense, as we rolled away, that something had been deliberately left unsaid in those warm rooms. At Brackwell, Poirot insisted we begin at the ticket office. The clerk, a sandy-haired fellow with the air of a man who had been counting change since birth, recognized Harcourt's name instantly, but swore with evident sincerity that no such gentleman as Reginald Davenham had passed through in months. "If he had, sir," the man added, "we'd have had the police here quick enough. There's orders, you see."
"Just so," Poirot murmured. "And you, monsieur, you would remember his face at once?"
"That I would," the clerk assured us. "Tall, thin, hair going grey, carries himself like a man what's never had to hurry. Not the sort you forget."
Poirot studied him with that unblinking green gaze of his for a heartbeat, then thanked the man and led me onto the platform.
"You note, Hastings, that our friend has described precisely your Mr. Davenham, and yet says he has not seen him. Voila the paradox. We next found the guard from the day before, Bernard Summers, by the luggage trolleys, lantern under one arm, uniform brushed to perfection. He listened to my account with the indulgence one gives to children and amateur conjurers.
'Begging your pardon, sir, but I locked you in myself. First-class rear compartment, door to the left. No one else inside. I'd have noticed if the Archbishop of Canterbury had joined you, let alone Mr. Davenham.' 'You are sure?'
Poirot's voice was silk. 'As sure as I'm standing here, sir.' Summer's gaze was steady, but there was a tautness in his jaw I had not marked before. 'Alors, you do not even say, "I think so," or "It is probable." You are sure, sure, sure. It is very firm, that certainty,' Poirot said, tapping him lightly on the sleeve. 'Almost as if it had been, how do you say, rehearsed before a mirror.' Summers coloured. 'I only mean I know my job, sir.' Poirot inclined his head and let it drop, but I knew the man's excessive certainty had been filed away in Poirot's mind, like an exhibit in an evidence case. We walked to the far end of the platform where the gas lamp of my story still stood, its glass globe filmed with the smoke of a dozen winter evenings. Beyond lay the hoardings, plastered with advertisements for biscuits and bicycle tires. No trapdoor, no gate, no opening.
'Voila,' Poirot said softly. 'Your empty air.'
I stared at the unremarkable boards, feeling again the shock of that instant when Davenham and the man in tweed had seemed to melt into nothingness. 'Poirot,' I said, 'I know what I saw.'
'Mais oui. But we must also know how you saw it. The trick, mon ami, is never to call a thing impossible too soon.'
We left the platform and crossed the cobbled square to the station tea room beside the post office. Its windows were steamed over, the aroma of boiled cabbage competing with fresh coffee. Inside, two elderly ladies in hats like miniature fortifications debated seed catalogues, while a boy in an apron wiped tables with missionary zeal. We took a seat by the window and ordered coffee from a girl who seemed relieved to have a straightforward request. Poirot was silent for a time, stirring his cup in precise revolutions. At last he said, 'You remark, Hastings, that Summers is too certain, that the clerk remembers too well the man he has not seen, and that in both cases there is perhaps a reason they do not wish to remember otherwise. That reason, we must find it.'
'And where do we begin?'
Parbleu, with the facts you have brought. The meeting under the lamp, the man in tweed, the mention of the chalk pits, a short walk from Brackwell on the far side of the ridge. And above all, this.' He asked me to draw the cigar case from my pocket and to lay it between us. 'This is the bridge between the world of your eyes and the world of my reason. Without it, I should think you had dreamed. With it, ah, I must think harder.' We left the square behind, striking out along a narrow lane that curved between hedgerows, stripped bare by winter. The air had that raw metallic taste that comes before frost, and our breath rose before us like small private clouds.
"The chalk pits," Poirot said quietly, "are not so far. A mile, perhaps. It is well to see them now before we speak again to Colonel Harcourt."
The lane soon gave way to a rutted cart track, the ground firm with the cold. A rook wheeled overhead, its cry falling oddly flat against the white rolling ridge ahead. As we climbed, the wind freshened, carrying a faint mineral tang. The pits themselves appeared without warning, a sudden yawning slash in the earth, their pale flanks glowing dully in the low light. A few straggling bushes clung to the rim, roots exposed like clutching fingers. Below lay a scatter of broken timber and rusted iron, relics of old workings abandoned to the weather. Poirot advanced to the fence with a care that was almost ceremonious. "Regardez," he murmured. "It pretends to guard, but see where it has yielded." The paling, bent inward at one section, bore the fresh scrape of nails on wood. Poirot knelt, drawing from his pocket a small folding lens. "Two sets of prints, Hastings. One heavy, the heel deep, the toe scarcely touching. A man who leans on his step, perhaps from illness or fatigue. The other, lighter, more even, with the decisiveness of one accustomed to walking in all weathers." He moved along the fence, eyes lowered. At a knot in the wire, he reached delicately and retrieved a shred of grey wool, no larger than a postage stamp. "Tweed," he observed, "coarse weave, and here..." He straightened, gesturing toward a half-submerged plank near the drop. A faint smear of boot black ran across it, dulled but still distinct. "One steps here, steadies himself, then goes down." I peered over. The floor of the pit was pocked with shallow puddles, their surfaces trembling in the wind. Between them lay darker patches of churned earth, as though something, or someone, had been dragged. The place had an odd stillness, broken only by the dry rattle of dead gorse against the fence. "It's not the most welcoming of spots," I said, trying to keep my voice steady. Poirot gave a small shrug. "Non. Yet it has the advantage for those who wish to pass unseen. One may descend from here, walk along the floor, shielded from view, and emerge. Where? That is what we must learn." He turned away at last, brushing his gloved hands together. As we retraced our steps, I found myself glancing back more than once, half expecting to see some movement below. But the pit lay empty, pale and inscrutable, holding its secrets in the cold light. Our walk back to the hall took us past the vicarage, where the colonel's new lamps stood at attention like soldiers on parade. Poirot paused to admire them, or so it seemed. But I noticed his eyes fixed on the muddy verge opposite, where fresh tire tracks cut sharply across the grass. "You observe, Hastings?" "These are not the wheels of a farm cart. Narrow, close set, a motor car, and one in haste."
"Could be anyone's," I said.
"Could be, yes, but will it be? That is what we must discover." When we reached Haversley Hall, Mrs. Harcourt was in the morning room, a letter half written before her. She greeted us with a smile that faltered ever so slightly when Poirot mentioned our visit to Brackwell and the chalk pits.
"Oh, those dreadful places," she said. "I cannot think why anyone would go there. Dangerous and quite unromantic."
Poirot inclined his head. "Dangerous, yes, but sometimes, madame, danger has its attraction." Her eyes flickered, the merest shadow, and she returned to her letter. Poirot let the subject drop, but as we left the room he murmured, "There, Hastings, the first chink in the armour." That evening, over a second helping of the hall's excellent treacle tart, he added, "Tomorrow we shall go to the village and make the acquaintance of those who see everything and forget nothing."
Chapter 5. Threads in the Village.
The next morning broke with a thin, milky light that seemed to flatten the world, as if the colours themselves were waiting for permission to appear. The fire in our grate had burned low, and the faint scent of last night's embers lingered. When I joined Poirot in the breakfast room, he was already there, contemplating a boiled egg, with the same care he might give to a witness whose testimony was about to betray them. "Our Hastings," he said, tapping the shell with a delicate precision. "Today we make the acquaintance of the village. These people..." He spread his fingers like a conjurer about to reveal a trick. "They are as the little birds. If you rush upon them, poof, they fly away, but with patience they tell you everything." "I've always thought of country villages as the very soul of discretion," I remarked. A soft chuckle escaped him. "That, mon ami, is because you take the discretion at face value. It is not that they do not speak. It is that they speak only to those who listen in the proper manner. And this morning we shall listen together." By 10 o'clock we were walking down the long gravel drive. The air was sharp enough to water the eyes, and the frost of the day before had given way to a damp mildness. A low mist clung stubbornly to the hedgerows, blurring the spire of the church that rose ahead of us. The village lay half a mile away, its roofs huddled as though sharing warmth against the season. Somewhere, unseen, a cartwheel creaked over cobbles, and a dog barked twice before deciding the matter was not worth the effort. Our first port of call was the post office, which also served as a general store. A small bell above the door announced us, and the mingled scents of brown paper, paraffin, and boiled sweets pressed in at once. Behind the counter, a woman of middle years, hair coiled in an unassailable knot, gave us a glance that weighed us as one might weigh an unexpected parcel. "Good morning, madam," Poirot began, bowing slightly. "We are visitors to your charming village. I am hoping you may assist us with some little inquiries." The woman's suspicion melted into guarded curiosity. "Depends on the inquiries, sir. We seek a gentleman who may have been seen in these parts. Tall, thin, graying hair, a certain air of distinction. His name is Reginald Davenham." Her lips pursed. "Can't say I know the name, but..." She glanced toward the window before leaning over the counter. "There was a stranger here Tuesday. Cigarettes and a newspaper. Paid in cash. Spoke little, but looked like he had his root fixed in his head." Poirot inclined his head. "And this was Tuesday afternoon?" "At around 5:30, came from the station." I met Poirot's eye. Tuesday had been the day of my strange encounter. From the post office, we stepped into a lane where the mist was lifting reluctantly. Across the way, the Green Man Inn swung its creaking signboard. Inside, the smell of wood smoke and ale was a warm embrace. The landlord, a broad man with forearms like rolled hams, looked us over without surprise. "You're the chaps from the hall," he said, setting down 2 cups of coffee, an order which had lifted his eyebrow a fraction. "Word gets round." "Indeed," Poirot replied. "And perhaps other words have gone round. About strangers?" The landlord scratched his chin. "Old Mrs. Pratt saw a man by the vicarage Tuesday night. Tall, collar up, near bowled her over. Didn't stop. Thought he might be a surveyor, but there's no call for surveying here." "Tuesday night," I said. "That's right. Cold enough to make a man hurry." Poirot made a small, thoughtful sound and sipped his coffee as though timing the pause precisely. We moved on, to the baker's with its yeasty warmth, the cobbler's smelling of leather and oil, and a small shop that offered everything from hairpins to rabbit traps. In each, Poirot's politeness was like a locksmith's pick, slipping the tumblers into place. We collected fragments, a sighting of a man in tweed on the ridge path, just over from Brackwell Station, beyond the far side of the ridge, the cough of a motor car starting late at night, a stranger asking the way to the hall. By noon we were walking back toward Haversley, the mist now little more than a silver thread above the fields. I had the feeling of pieces sliding toward one another, though the picture they would form was still hidden from me. Halfway up the drive, Colonel Harcourt appeared at a brisk pace.
his ruddy face marked with puzzlement.
"There you are. Mrs. Harcourt hopes you'll join us for luncheon. We've had a note, delivered by hand. No postmark. Pushed under the door."
In the library, Mrs. Harcourt stood by the writing table. Without a word, she handed Poirot a single sheet of paper, the handwriting neat and unhurried.
"Leave well enough alone. No good will come of digging in the past. No signature."
Poirot studied it a moment, then passed it to me. "You see, Hastings, we are not the only ones interested in this affair. And our correspondent, he prefers the past to remain, how do you say, buried."
Mrs. Harcourt's voice was calm, but her fingers rested a little too lightly on the edge of the desk. "I suppose this means you'll go on all the more."
"But naturally, madame," said Poirot with a small bow, "for now we know the path we tread is also trodden by others."
That evening in our rooms, Poirot sat by the fire, fingertips together, the note beside him.
"Tomorrow, Hastings, we go to London. The board of the Southern Metropolitan once handled a delicate matter regarding Monsieur Davenham's unpaid shares, suspended when he vanished. Such records may speak, even if the good gentlemen of the board do not. And," his eyes glinted, "one of their number is known to Colonel Harcourt. A social courtesy will open the door. They will expect pleasantries. I shall offer suspicion. After that, perhaps, we shall have all the threads we need to draw the net closed."
Chapter 6. What Cannot Be Explained. The morning drew itself thin and brittle over Haversley, a frost-like ground glass laid carefully upon lawn and laurel. The air had the chill of a church corridor. Mrs. Harcourt came down with us to the steps. She had the look of a woman who had rehearsed composure and now wore it well, though not comfortably. The motor idled, white breath furling from the exhaust, and Poirot, who had dressed for London as other men dress for an audience, immaculate tie, spats that made the gravel ashamed of itself, bowed over our hostess's hand with an old-world courtesy that made her smile in spite of herself.
"You will telephone, whatever the outcome," she asked.
"But certainly, madame," said Poirot. "I promise you the consideration."
Colonel Harcourt's man drove us through the thin sunlight to Chatterford. As we passed the ridge, the line of the chalk pits lay white and sullen beneath the bare hedges. I glanced at Poirot. He was gazing out with an air of abstraction that I have come to mistrust. When Poirot looks most disengaged, he is, in fact, most precise. The train toward London had the pleasant anonymity of mid-morning business. Men in sober suits folded newspapers as if they contained private misfortunes. A lady in a cloche hat performed an entire toilette with a compact mirror no larger than a crown piece. Poirot made of the compartment a little chapel. He drew out the cigar case I had brought him and placed it on the seat beside him as though laying a small relic to rest.
"You arrange your altar?"
I said, attempting lightness. He smiled. "The exhibits, mon ami. Always one should make them speak if they wish." He tapped the lid with a finger. "Harrods, you see. The engraving, very new, very sharp, on the serif of the R, done within the year. A man who buys for himself at such a place, and recently, is not the man who plans to become a fugitive. Voila the contradiction that I love. And add to it the time of the deed of sale, 8:30 in the evening. Absurd for a thief who means to vanish with the money earlier that day." "Non. Our Mr. Davenham is either a fool, which from Hastings' description he is not, or he is engaged in something regular, correct, of the law."
"And yet," I said, "he has vanished completely. And if what they say is true, he is dead."
Poirot's eyes half closed. "That, my friend, is the fact upon which everything must turn." He spoke little after that. Once he asked me, with an air of trifling, to repeat the exact intonation with which Davenham had said, "The old chalk pits." When I obliged, he made a small gesture of satisfaction, as if a picture had settled straight upon the nail. London, when we reached it, wore its weekday face. The pavements had that dry, efficient sound beneath the traffic
one associates with a budget being balanced. The Southern Metropolitan's offices were in a respectable street, whose windows had seen better anxieties. We mounted steps polished to a civic conscience, and were received, after the proper delay, by a clerk who had imagined the words "not more than 5 minutes" on our behalf before anyone had spoken them. The committee room was large, and smelt faintly and uniformly of vellum. There were half a dozen gentlemen present. One rose to greet us with the cordiality of a man who has told himself to be cordial until he has almost believed himself. Colonel Harcourt's acquaintance, Mr. Rivington, a spare man with iron-grey hair and the impression of a lifelong argument with his tailor, made the introductions and then sat as if he had been told off by a sergeant-major to sit and would do so until relieved. "You understand, Captain Hastings," said the chairman, whose eyebrows had taken the precaution of bristling before his voice began, "that this is an informal inquiry. The police have their sphere, we ours. We should be glad of your account." I told it. I have seldom been so conscious of being believed only in so far as belief was convenient. They heard me without impatience, but the patience had the quality of a ledger. It balanced in their favour whatever was put into it. Poirot did not speak. He sat a little behind and to my left with his fingertips together and an expression of meekness that would have deceived a bishop. The chairman consulted a sheet before him. "We have also summoned Guard Summers, who was on duty during the journey in question. The company requires his testimony given the serious nature of Captain Hastings' claims." Next, they examined the guard, Summers. He repeated, with an almost touching confidence, the tale we already knew. He had personally locked my door. I had travelled alone. No one had entered or left. He could not be mistaken. He finished with the look of a man who has recited the catechism and expects a boiled sweet. Poirot, when permitted a question, merely said in that soft voice which makes men firmer or falter, but never leaves them as it found them, "Monsieur Summers, the key with which you locked the door, such keys, they are common to all first-class compartments of that series, are they not?" Summers blinked. "Well, yes, sir, the same pattern, that is." "And if a person, say a gentleman of the board, had, for his convenience, such a key—" Poirot shrugged apologetically. "It would not be, how do you say, irregular?" Summers looked at the chairman. The chairman's eyebrows rose by fractions. "Keys are issued only to responsible officials, Mr. Poirot," he said. "Mais oui," murmured Poirot. "Responsible." The guard was dismissed with a sound like a page turned. There was a pause. A clerk entered to place before the chairman a ledger bound in Morocco. He was sandy-haired, with a neat moustache. He moved in the precise economical way of a man who has learned to fit his life between the lines of a minute book. I did not cry out this time, but I felt the jolt as if a sleeper had moved beneath the train. Poirot's head inclined by the smallest degree. "Monsieur," he said pleasantly, "forgive me. You are?"
"Roque, sir."
He stood straight, the book against his hip. "Alfred Roques." "And you have been with the Southern Metropolitan?"
8 years, sir."
"Ah," said Poirot, with admiration for the number itself, "then you will know everything. A marvel." There was, at this, the faintest tightening about Roques's mouth. Men who are told they know everything rarely like to be told so in public. He placed the ledger, bowed to the chairman, and would have withdrawn. Poirot stepped one pace only, no more, and stood where the door could still be seen, but not easily reached. "Monsieur Roques," he said, as if a casual thought had occurred to him and might as well be disposed of, "the little note that came to Haversley yesterday, leave well enough alone. It was written, I think, with J. Herb in ink violet of a kind supplied to the board offices." A low surprise went round the table, like wind through corn. Roques stopped.
"I shouldn't know, sir."
"But I should," murmured Poirot. He drew from his pocket a slip of paper, the anonymous note itself, which Colonel Harcourt had pressed upon him last night, and another sheet. This one an extract copied with scrupulous accuracy from a memorandum in the board's files, dated some years earlier, concerning the audit of certain unpaid shares attached to the issue for the Brackwell Marlingworth branch. The phrasing, trim, precise, a little priggish, was to my ear identical. "You will observe, messieurs," said Poirot to the table at large, "the very particular mannerism, the little insistence upon the order of two adjectives. No good will come, and here no profit can come. It is not conclusive, no, but it is a thread." Roques's gaze went not to the chairman nor to the door, but to the clock. "The hour is interesting to you?" asked Poirot gently. "It is to me also. For example, the deed of sale which concerned Mr. Davenham, set for 8:30 in the evening." "Yet when Mr. Davenham disappeared in September, it was immediately after he had uncovered these same irregularities in your books. The deficit was discovered by the company only because he had found it first, and someone needed him to appear guilty of the very crime he was trying to expose. And, attention, monsieur, there is in your own records a discrepancy that shows the careful timing of this deception." The chairman stirred. "We have not asked you here to lecture us on our balances, sir." "No, Monsieur le Président," returned Poirot, with both hands spread in a deprecating fan. "You have asked us so that Captain Hastings might say what he has seen. Permit that I say why he has seen it." There was at this the slightest movement of the sandy moustache. I felt, rather than saw, the colour ebb and return along Roques's jaw. "Consider," continued Poirot, still mild. "In September, Mr. Davenham discovers certain, how shall we say, irregularities in the company accounts. Unpaid shares moved like pieces on a chessboard, temporary advances to cover deficits, the delicate manipulation of audit dates. But our Mr. Davenham, he is not a man to be silent when money goes astray. He begins to ask questions." Poirot paused, his eyes moving deliberately around the table. "But questions, monsieur, they make certain persons nervous. And a nervous person, especially one with access to the books, such a person begins to think that perhaps the questioner should be made to appear guilty of the very crime he seeks to expose. A most elegant solution, non? The money disappears, Mr. Davenham disappears, and who will suspect that the thief is the very man who reports the theft?" Davenham realized this trap was closing around him. So what does an intelligent man do? He vanishes, not with the money as was intended to appear, but to protect himself while he gathers the proof he needs. For 3 months he remains hidden, watching, waiting, accumulating evidence. Then, in December, he emerges to complete his legitimate business, the land purchase that will vindicate his honor. He is not a thief, for he buys very lately a cigar case at Harrods, and he sends to his cousin a message exceedingly particular about a certain blue room chimney. Details, details, details. Those are the habits of the honest man returning to reclaim his reputation. Poirot's fingertip tapped, softly, the Morocco case on the table before him. "He comes to Brackwell. There a man is waiting in tweed, who knows the timetables better than any porter. This man walks with him, away from the road over the ridge, to the chalk pits. Why there? Because the sound of a motor cannot be heard easily from the station road, because the chalk keeps its marks, unless the frost comes, because it is just out of sight and out of mind. You see, monsieur, our Mr. Davenham believed he was meeting someone who would help him present his evidence to the proper authorities. Instead, he met the very man whose crimes he had uncovered. Monsieur Roques could not allow Davenham to return to society with proof of the financial manipulations. The missing money was never stolen by Davenham. It was moved by someone who understood the company books intimately, someone who could make the records dance to any tune he chose to play." Poirot's eyes, which had been placid, became for a moment very bright. "And then, how do you say, the improvisation? The blow that is too hard? The taking of the notes? Not all, no, the man is prudent. He hides a portion under a hearthstone. He spends very little. He returns to his desk and writes a small note to Haversley with the hand that writes the board memoranda, and he says to himself, "The guard, he is proud. He will say what is comfortable to say." And so he has said.
"Monsieur!"
The chairman half rose, but it was not indignation. It was the involuntary recoil of a man who sees a case harden around him as plaster hardens. Roques had not moved. Only his hands, which were well-kept hands, had taken up the back of the nearest chair with an attention out of proportion to the chair's deserts. "You have no proof," he said. The words were level, but they had the sound of a plank laid down hastily over water. "Pardon?" said Poirot. "I have many small proofs. Together they are large." He counted them, almost lazily, on the tips of his fingers. "Un, the handwriting and the ink. Deux, the timetable which does not accord with theft. Trois, the knowledge of the ridge path and the chalk pits, knowledge that belongs to the employee who runs messages to the station more than to the director who comes down from London. Quatre, the description given by Captain Hastings of the man beneath the lamp. Cinq, the over-certainty of the guard, which tells me he has been told to be certain by someone he perceives as a superior. Six, this." From his pocket, he produced a small folded thing wrapped in tissue, the sort of envelope jewelers give to customers who demand that the world be indulgent to trifles. He opened it, and upon the white rested a tiny sliver of pale fibre and a second speck dark and glossy. "This," said Poirot, almost regretfully, "is a splinter of gauze that I removed this morning from the cuff of a coat hanging in your outer office, just there, upon the tree. The coat is yours, Monsieur Roques. The porter told me so with the pride of a man who admires neatness. And this," he indicated the dark speck, "is a grain of dried chalk such as the pits provide. It is not much, but it is not the dust of a London street." It was very quiet. The clock in the hall, which had previously been engaged in the decent business of marking time for respectable men, now seemed impertinent. Roques's fingers had left the chair back and gone to his moustache, and from there to the line of his collar, as if the one were suddenly too small and the other suddenly too high. "Shall I add," said Poirot, almost kindly, "that you are the only person in this building who both writes the board memoranda and carries, upon your watch-chain, a railway key of the older pattern. I observed it as you placed the ledger. The shape is distinctive. It opens very nicely a certain kind of carriage door." There is a moment at which a man ceases to calculate loss, and looks instead for an end. I saw it then. Roques's eyes went to the door a second time, and faltered upon Poirot's slight figure between him and any flight, a figure that would not in any case have been needed. It was not strength that barred his way, but certainty. "It was not meant," he began, and stopped. He swallowed. "It was not meant to be a killing. He said he would expose the matter of the unpaid shares, how we had moved the paper, covered the deficit, kept it off the audit with a temporary advance, only a matter of days. There was to be a bridging loan." His voice, which had the pedantry of a clerk, failed him. "He was a proud man. He said my name to my face as if it were dirt." "When did he first discover your activities, Monsieur Roques?" asked Poirot quietly. Roques's voice was barely audible. "September. He found discrepancies in the Brackwell-Marlingworth accounts, said he would expose everything unless it was corrected immediately. I told him there were complications, that it would take time to untangle, but he didn't trust me. He said he would handle it himself, take it directly to the board." "And so you allowed him to appear as the thief?" "It was never meant to be permanent," Roques burst out. "Just until I could replace the money from other sources. But he disappeared before I could arrange anything, and then everyone assumed—" He swallowed. "When he contacted me in December, said he was ready to present evidence that would clear his name, I knew it was all over."
"Go on," said the chairman harshly. "We walked to the ridge, said Roakes. Because I did not wish to be seen with him by the road, there was a piece of timber left from old scaffolding. I meant only—" He raised one hand helplessly. "It was the blow. He fell too quickly. I took the notes from his person and the box from his hand. He had locked it. I threw the box down the slope into the scrub. You will find it if you rake there. Then I dragged the—" He stopped. There was a dryness to the word he could not manage. "No more," said Poirot very quietly. "You will tell the rest to the proper officer." It was all very tidy after that, which is the English talent in such matters. A message was sent by telephone. There were men with calm faces who came and went. The chairman, who had taken no side and would surely never consent to be seen to take any, made at the last a minute motion with one hand in the air that had the effect of drawing a veil over the room's embarrassment. By mid-afternoon we were at the chalk pits again. The winter light had thinned to a pewter disk behind ragged cloud. A robin sat upon the bent wire and regarded us with that cheerful, implacable attention which robins bring to tragedy. The police had preceded us with a discretion that did them credit. It was not long before one of the constables, having moved aside a tangle of brushwood where the slope hollowed, called up in a voice that no longer belonged to the day's ordinary business. We went down. I am no stranger to death, but there is something in the cold of chalk that makes a man feel he has come to the wrong side of the map. They had found him where Roakes said he would be, beneath a drift of dead leaves and blackened twig. The wound, there is no need to dress it in language, told its tale. Poirot took off his hat. He is not, by nature, ceremonious with the dead. He is ceremonious with the living. But here he stood a moment, and his face was not the face he wears for puzzles. He bent so slightly that it could not be called a bow, and then he turned away and began, with the thoroughness of a housewife, to inspect the ground. Presently he stooped, reached under a scrub of bramble, and drew out the deed box. The lock was sprung. The corner had taken a blow. "Eh bien," he said, "he is where he should be." His hand rested for an instant on the japanned lid. "It is of the world again. The rest you will have read in the papers. Roakes was charged, and after a postponement or two that gave the news columns leisure to find adjectives, tried. He pled manslaughter. The jury found otherwise. Sentence was duly carried out. The money recovered from under the hearthstone at his lodgings went back, by a tidy line of receipts, to the Southern Metropolitan. The board expressed, in print of moderate size, its satisfaction with the due processes of law. There remained, however, the matter that was not for the newspapers. A week after the discovery, I found Poirot in the library at Haversley, in the hour before dinner when lamps have been lit and the house is conscious of its own warmth. He had placed the cigar case upon the mantel shelf. It looked oddly domestic there, as if it might presently produce not cigars, but a family photograph. "Poirot," I said. "When we found him, the doctor confirmed he had been dead since Tuesday night, killed just hours after I spoke with him on the train. It seems almost cruel, somehow, that I should have been the last person to see him alive, and yet powerless to prevent what followed." "Ah, mon ami," Poirot said gently, tending the fire with meticulous care. "But you were not powerless. Without your encounter, without your testimony, Roakes would never have been brought to justice. Still, it haunts me. He seemed so composed, so certain of his business. Did he know, do you think, what awaited him?" Poirot, who had replaced the poker with his usual precision, turned to face me. "I think, Hastings, that Mr. Davenham was a man who had lived for weeks in fear, knowing that someone wished him harm. When he emerged from hiding to complete his transaction, he took what precautions he could, dividing his money, choosing his route carefully, even speaking to you of family details that would prove his identity if needed." "The message about the chimney sweeping," I said. "Precisely. A man who suspects he may not survive the evening ensures that his affairs are known to trustworthy witnesses." Poirot's voice grew thoughtful.
He had been hiding since September, you understand. Not dead, as everyone assumed, but alive and fearful. He knew the danger. And yet he came out of hiding. Because, mon ami, he was fundamentally an honest man, he could not let the theft stand unchallenged, even if challenging it cost him his life. And perhaps, Poirot's eyes grew distant, perhaps he trusted that speaking to you, leaving that cigar case where it would be found, would ensure the truth would eventually emerge. The room was quiet, save for the soft settling of coals in the grate. So there was no mystery, then, I said at last. Just a man trying to do right, who ran out of time. C'est ça, Poirot agreed softly. Sometimes, Hastings, the truth is simpler than we expect, but no less tragic for its simplicity. There was a gentle tap at the door, and Mrs. Harcourt came in. She held herself as a woman holds herself who has had practice at it. Her eyes went at once to the cigar case on the shelf. "I wondered," she said, "if that were his." "It is, madame," said Poirot. She stood a moment, and I saw in her face, not grief exactly which had done its work, but the particular fatigue that follows the settling of an account one never wished to have. "My cousin was a difficult man," she said, "but he was..." She hesitated. "He was not mean."
"No," said Poirot. "He was not mean, and in the end, madame, he chose honour over safety. That is not a small thing."
She gave the smallest of nods. "You have been very gentle, Monsieur Poirot. With us, and with the truth." She took a breath. "You will dine with us again, both of you, before you go." "With pleasure," said Poirot. And there was for a moment nothing in the room but ordinary life, a fire, a dinner to be arranged, the sound of the butler moving with the grave economy of linen. Later, as we walked through the hall, a faint vibration came to us from the night outside, the far, familiar tremor of a train crossing the ridge. It gave the glass in the fanlight the slightest shiver. I could not help it. I paused, thinking of that Tuesday afternoon journey, of a man who had known his danger and faced it anyway.
"Come, mon ami," said Poirot very gently. "We have dined. We have solved. We have remembered. That is enough for one case."
He took up the cigar case as we went into the drawing room. It lay in his hand like a simple memorial to a man who had chosen truth over safety and paid the price that honest men sometimes must. And so ends The Gentleman on the Platform. If you've listened to the very last word, you are part of the reason these mysteries live on. Your comments, your sharing of these tales, and your direct support make it possible for us to keep bringing you Poirot's cases, Hastings' voice, and the shadows in which these stories breathe. Producing each story, from the first spark of an idea to the final sound in your ear, is a labor of time and care. If you believe in what we're building here, consider joining our membership for ad-free access and exclusive stories, or leaving a tip to help fund future investigations. Even the smallest gesture tells us, yes, keep going. Until our next mystery, good night.